It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a new report out about chemicals in Lake Michigan.
But first, the Packers played their first game of the season yesterday, losing to the San Francisco 49ers.
Now that the NFL season is full swing, critics, analysts are asking if football can face what they call its demons, referring to the recent concussion settlement, arrests of some players, the murder trial of Aaron Hernandez. Is this something the NFL can overcome or needs to overcome?
Do you think the NFL can overcome some of its most recent hurdles? And has any of the bad stuff about football been keeping you away? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jason Keitel joins us now. He's sports writer for CBS in New York City. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So before this football season started, they got some headlines maybe they didn't exactly want. The NFL settled a case out of court with over 4,000 former football players. They had sued the NFL for concussion-related injuries. Some people have said, oh, the NFL just wanted to get that done before the season started. Did you make anything of the timing?
I did make something of the timing. The shield, of course, the shield being the NFL logo, is always concerned with its appearance and its appeal to the public. It was twofold. One, they were concerned about the public relations hit it would take. And also, they wanted to settle before going to trial because they did not want to reveal any research, any information that may have cast a bad light upon them. In other words, any information they may have had on concussions and the impact football had on young men. The settlement sort of absolves them in that regard. They didn't have to reveal any research they may have done on football and head injuries, which is the people who the greatest detractors of the settlement. That was their biggest beef. One, they felt they should have held out more money, and two, they wanted to get into the sort of the meat of the investigation, which is, you know, reveal the papers, what did they know and when did they know it kind of thing.
Do you think that fans in general, either serious fans or maybe those more on the margins, are worried about this? Do you think people are saying, this concussion thing, it's turning me off the game a little bit?
I think the civilized thing would be to say yes, but I don't think so. I think people who were opposed to the sport in general or opposed to having those children play it, this sort of just reinforces how they feel about it. I think people on the margins, as you say, might be slightly affected by it. I've heard a number of people, and I've spoken to a number of people who have said, I do not want my child to play football, and this, you know, merely confirms that feeling. But generally speaking, if you feel strongly one way or another, I don't think this affects it. I think it would be more of an issue for parents than it would be for fans. In other words, a fan is on the periphery anyway, so we're not really impacted one way or another by it. But vis-a-vis parents and children, it certainly raises a few flags. But I don't think if Johnny really wants to play football and the parent wants to please the child, I don't know that this really is going to affect it, because we don't have enough data yet on the impact it has on the Pop Warner kid, on the high school kid. I think we are more concerned by the college and NFL impact, because we're obviously larger, the hits are stronger, and thus the concussions will be stronger and the head injuries will be more pronounced. But I don't think there's enough data out there to say one way or another what it will do to a child.
Well, we've seen comments like from people like the father of Tom Brady, New England Patriots quarterback. His dad said, if I had it to do over again, I don't know if I'd have him play. Or Kurt Warner, a star quarterback himself, saying he's a little squeamish maybe about his own kids playing. Those are a couple names that it's kind of interesting to hear that they're even feeling a little squeamish about it.
Well, what's interesting also is like any deleterious behavior, it seems to have a different impact on different people. In other words, I grew up a Steelers fan in the 70s. And when I was a child, I remember Lynn Swann being carted off constantly from hits from Jack Tatum and George Atkinson and various Raiders or whomever. And yet, he's very lucid, very active, very prosperous, very aware of his surroundings. Whereas you have people who weren't not, at least outwardly, affected, it didn't seem, by concussions, and yet they have been debilitated beyond repair. So, again, it's sort of this murky area where we cannot exactly define what hit does what to somebody else. For example, Troy Aikman was forced into retirement because of concussions, yet Troy seems very articulate and seems to do broadcasts for the NFL on Fox without any impediment. So, yeah, it's easy to say in retrospect I wouldn't have my kid do it, but I don't know that we have enough proof that that would happen.
On a more fundamental level, and you hear this argument fairly often, we know that football is a high-impact game. We know there are dangers of long-term injury. As long as kids know what they're getting into when they go into the game, and maybe the pros know it and they're making lots of money, what's the big deal?
Well, absolutely. And then we get to the matter of choice. In other words, how much do we want to legislate human behavior? Obviously, if somebody's 10 years old, the parents become the ultimate governing body. But once Johnny is 18 years old and he wants to play football, who are we, who is anyone, to stop them from doing that? Again, I think that was the biggest problem with this settlement, was that we do not know exactly how much research the NFL has done. You know, the NFL is engaged in this kind of this sort of retrograde analysis. You know, it's like a form of foxhole prayer. Once they realized they were in deep water, they became humanitarians. You know, I don't know if you remember, but just 5 years ago, ESPN used to have this segment every Sunday called Jacked Up.
Right,
the hardest hits humanly possible, knock the snot out of someone, everybody chuckles around the table, and now it's a taboo. So, you know, I think we're all a little bit sanctimonious in that regard, because I myself, and I think a lot of people, took some delight out of the violence of the sport. And now that it has become politically incorrect to do so, we pretend to be a bit more civilized. But I think the violence of the game kind of speaks to our nature. And I hate to sound like a savage, but one of the part of the appeal of football is its violence.
Well, another headline, I guess, the NFL didn't want earlier this year, off-field violence. Most notably, former New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez, a murder trial. And, of course, we hear in the papers from time to time other, maybe not so bad as murder, but other criminal cases. Is there a crime problem with NFL players, or is there a lot of media attention when there is a crime problem?
I would tend to say the latter. I think that the crimes tend to become amplified because they are celebrities, they're stars, they're young, they're rich, they're handsome, they're at the peak of their appetites. I think young, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think you'll find that men who commit crime tend to be in the very demographic we're watching in the NFL. You don't think, at least I wouldn't assume that 50-year-olds are the ones out committing murder. It would tend to be people of Aaron Hernandez's vintage. It is a problem. At the same time, how do you prevent it? And what my biggest problem with the Hernandez case, and I wrote extensively about this for CBS, is this notion that the Patriots, I don't know, you recall that Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, said he was duped. He wasn't duped. Every NFL team has a phalanx of former cops on them. They do tons of research. They do tons of background checks. They know almost everything. I remember Chris Carter talking the other day, the former wide receiver for the Vikings, who just was inducted to the Hall of Fame. He said the Eagles and then the Vikings went back to his grade school days, interviewing people from his childhood. So we know that there are some bad apples out there. But the question is, the NFL is taking a chance. They're weighing the risk versus the reward. In terms of keeping them from playing, unless you've committed a certifiable crime like Aaron Hernandez, what do you do? You tell them they can't pursue their dreams because they may do something in the future? It's a very tough thing to do, but I think, again, it's amplified because of the celebrity.
We focused on a couple of the big problems here, the concussions and the crimes. By and large, though, NFL's doing pretty well, isn't it?
Well, if you consider $9 billion good, yes, they're doing quite well. The revenue is just growing exponentially. And now that you have these sort of branches of digital media brands, it's just going to take off. I've heard some estimates that by 2016, the NFL will generate close to $15 billion annually. It's basically it's a personal mint. It really is. They have, first of all, the product itself is a very good product if you obviously take away the glitches of crime and the spine and the brain damage and the crime. You also have just a beautiful product in terms of the symmetry and the way it's presented on television. As a matter of fact, the NFL is kind of worried about its game attendance at the stadium because it is such a wonderful product. And now you have DirecTV and the Red Zone channel and all these things. You know, you can watch the game on a 65-foot screen, and it feels like you're right there. You can practically see the player's nose hairs, whereas you don't want to necessarily go out in the weather and when it's 15 degrees outside and freeze your buns off when you can just watch it at home. So I think the NFL, they're just sort of they're masters at promoting their own product, and it is a great product. And frankly, we're hooked. I mean, let's be honest. The NFL has usurped baseball and basketball as America's game.
Talking to Jason Keitel, sports writer for CBS in New York City.
And what do you think? Do you think the NFL can overcome some of its most recent issues? And what do you think about letting your son or grandson play football? Does that bother you? And are you still watching the sport despite some of the issues we've been talking about today? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. And we're talking now about the demons professional football will have to face this season, like the concussion controversy and the arrest of players, to be specific, and wondering whether these things might get in the way of enjoyment for the fans.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Are you a football fan and you're going to watch the games? Does the news about concussions and this big concussion settlement make you think twice? Do you think changes need to be made, or it's just the nature of the game? 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. Oh, and why do you think football has taken over as America's game over baseball? I'll ask our guest that in just a minute, but first I want to get to the phones. We've got Shelby in Black River Falls. Shelby, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you today?
I'm good. What do you think about this?
The young lady I just spoke with when I called in, I really did have an opinion that my son, he's in Northern Nevada. I just recently got transferred back to Wisconsin, but he's been playing two seasons a year. They play spring and fall, Northern Nevada, up by Reno area. Mm-hmm. And these boys have all played together since the first grade. Most of them are straight-A students, 4.0s. I'd have to say probably at least 50% of them are 3.0 or higher. There has been some injuries, and something else, too. When you sign your release, and not verbatim, but close enough, it does state on the bottom, including up to death, mm-hmm. when you do sign your release for Pop Warner like that. So, I mean, I think the nature of the game is going to be injuries, stingers. Hunter's had to have a head x-ray once already.
But you think it's worth it? You think it's been good for him despite the injury?
Absolutely. It's teaching them camaraderie. You do have to, with the professional football, some of the boys like to emulate, and you have to nip that right in the bud.
I see that at the soccer games on the weekends, too. Shelby, thanks a lot for the call. Yep. So what do you think, Jason? Despite the risks, football for kids, probably other sports, too, has benefits that outweigh the risks.
He makes a wonderful point, which is we often laud the aesthetics of sports, the larger narrative being it teaches you discipline, teaches you teamwork, and the physical benefits of cardiovascular activity. By and large, you'll find, with some exceptions obviously, like head injury, you'll find by and large that sports are a very, very healthy endeavor. And I just wanted to get back real quick to the point you were talking about the arrests. You know, we're talking about between 30 and 35 people out of a league of 1,700. Mm. And when you think about it, it's a microscopic portion not only of civilization, but also of the sport itself. So, again, we focus on the negative, just as we focus on the truck fire on the shoulder of the road rather than getting to work. So there's a certain voyeuristic quality to it that we, unfortunately, do enjoy. But back to Shelby's point, yes, athletics, the benefits of athletics far outweigh the dangers. And I think people aren't worried about CTE, CTE being, of course, the central problem with head injury, which is basically a protein buildup in the brain. And I don't think that people believe that their child is building that protein at 10 years old.
I don't want to just focus on the negative. And you said just a few minutes ago that football has really supplanted baseball, basketball, the other sports as America's game. Is there something inherent about the sport? Or is it that the league, the NFL, has made choices and seized opportunities that the other professional sports leagues haven't?
Great question. It's both. It's a brilliant marketing strategy, and the game itself is so wonderful. And I think that football has replaced the other sports in a cultural sense as sort of the melting pot. I think you'll find that there have been an alarming number of minorities who have stopped playing baseball, at least in the United States. And I don't think you find as much diversity in basketball as you do in football. And I think that's a contributing factor as well.
And with the NFL, the salary cap is something that I always wonder, is that something that makes the difference as compared to other leagues where the salary cap briefly says the teams can only spend so much on their players? It supposedly guarantees some parity, competitiveness. Do you think that makes it more appealing than a game like baseball that doesn't have that?
Great, great question, Rob. Yes, absolutely. This sort of legislative socialism, this legislative parity. Yeah, you know, you wouldn't think that such a format would work in a capitalistic society, but it does. You know, basically, Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, wants everybody to go 8-8. And the beauty of that notion is that you can go, if you will, from zero to a hero in a season. You have teams like the Saints that can win 3 games 1 year and then win the Super Bowl the next. You had the Rams, who were wretched before Kurt Warner. You mentioned Kurt Warner. Before he got there, and then they win a Super Bowl. Football reinforces the notion that you can hit the jackpot overnight more than any other team. It always seems like the Lakers or the Celtics are dominating in basketball, and unfortunately, in my city here, the Yankees have a horrible reputation. They've even been called the Evil Empire for just outspending everybody else. That can't happen in football because you can only spend whatever it is, $80, $90 million a year on your team.
And I also wanted to ask the rise of fantasy sports. It's not unique to football, but it seems like, again, after some initial reluctance, the NFL kind of seized on that. Do you think that is part of the explanation for the growing appeal and maybe the growing revenue for the NFL?
Another excellent question. Yes. In fact, it's a two-pronged endeavor. You have fantasy sports, which seem to lend itself better to football than any other team sport in America. And let's be honest, the gorilla in the room is gambling. And I can't, it would be unfair to say 50% of Americans watch because they have money on the game, but countless billions of dollars are on every football game every Sunday. And that is a huge part of the draw of football.
And then some decisions the NFL has been playing with for a while. Right now, 4 preseason games for every team, 16 regular season games. There's been talk floated again and again. It seems like let's take 2 of those preseason games, make them a regular season game. What has been the argument pro or con there? And what do you think about that in the future of the league?
But that's going to fail, Rob. And I'll tell you why, because Roger Goodell will seem rather duplicitous. If he goes out on television, he tells everyone that he is given $30, $40, $50 million grants to scientists to research the effects that football has on the brain, and then he turns around at the same time and extends the season by 2 games. That would be a public relations disaster, and I don't see that happening. In terms of preseason, I've talked to coaches and general managers, and all of them say to a man that the 4 games are essential. Obviously, you know that Tom Brady is going to make your football team, but games 3 and 4 are essential to find out who's going to fill out the 53-man roster. And there is absolute uniformity in that regard. They say those games are essential. But the 2 extra games just won't fly if you're saying you're trying to protect the players, and then you put them in more peril by extending the season.
One hurdle the NFL hasn't really overcome, when people say football anywhere outside of this country, they think of what we call soccer. We had the World League of American Football, NFL Europe. NFL maybe, you know, they send some games to London, maybe want a franchise there. What's it going to take for NFL to really leap beyond the borders?
Well, what does it take any league? Money. right? I think it might, it's an odd analogy, but I think it works. There was a time, believe it or not, certainly before I was alive, that the Dodgers were in Brooklyn. And the problem with them moving to Los Angeles at the time, believe it or not, was travel. People did not believe that a team could thrive or even survive even in California, in this own country, because St. Louis, as of 1958, when the Dodgers moved, were the farthest team out west. Mm. So what they did was, instead of going out alone, they convinced the New York Giants to travel out to San Francisco to bring two baseball teams to California. So in the football context, I think you would have to bring two teams to Europe in order for that to work.
London versus Paris. We could see that someday. Jason, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, sir.
That's Jason Keitel, a sports writer for CBS in New York City.
Coming up, we'll talk about pharmaceuticals found in Lake Michigan.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to WPR's very own tech guy about what precautions you can take to avoid being hacked.
First, though, it's Great Lakes Week, and we're going to take a look at a new report out about chemicals found in Lake Michigan.
Scientists have known for years that there are pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the lake.
The prevailing wisdom used to be that the sheer volume of water in the Great Lakes diluted the chemicals and kept the environmental impact low.
The new study out by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee questions that, having found chemicals at concentrations that do pose a risk, especially for organisms near the shore, like fish and algae.
Here to talk with us about the findings is one of the authors of the study, Rebecca Clapper. She's an associate professor at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and the director of the Great Lakes Genomics Center. And Rebecca, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What chemicals were found in Lake Michigan?
Well, we monitored for about 60 different pharmaceuticals and personal care products, and we found varying levels of about 30 to 40 of them out in the lake. And these are either in the water or the sediment of the lake.
Now, I think you were scanning for things that were in personal care products and also for prescription medications. What did you find in highest concentrations?
Well, so one of the things that we found and that a lot of people find in these studies is that caffeine and its byproducts that our body breaks it down into are commonly found in sewage effluent and then also found in freshwater systems. So, you know, we all take our caffeine dose in our coffee or our tea or soda during the day, and that's reflected in the sewage outfall, and ends up going out in the lake. But then we also find some other things that are either common or less common medications, things like Prozac and some of the antibiotics. We also find the anti-diabetic drugs. So, for instance, Metformin is a type 2 diabetes drug that's used, and we find that in high levels coming out of the sewage treatment plant and then going out into the lake.
So is the takeaway here that the chemicals are getting into the water from human waste, or are they just being disposed of wholesale directly into the water?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we get that question a lot. And it's thought by the scientific community that, you know, people are taking their medications as they're prescribed, and what happens in your body is that your body either it changes the chemical just a little bit to get rid of it, or it when you take it, you end up, you know, peeing or excreting a bunch of it out into the sewage. And so the thought is it's not necessarily people dumping stuff down the drain, but a lot of it comes from people just taking their medications. And then our sewage treatment plants aren't designed to take those things out, although they do a pretty good job of taking out, you know, some of the compounds. It's just that there's some of them that make it all the way through and end up out in our freshwater system.
Now, this has got to be a pretty common phenomenon because just about everybody in their lifetime engages in use of chemicals, whether it's antibacterial soap, whether they're taking an antibiotic once a year or something like that. And I guess the prevailing wisdom used to be that the Great Lakes are massive bodies of water, so this stuff is going to get diluted and we don't have to worry about it. But that's really not what we found with this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of our surprising findings is that we were finding it, you know, a few miles out into the lake. And we were really anticipating, especially, considering the prevailing water and wind patterns, that we really wouldn't find it very consistently out, you know, a few miles out from where the sewage outfall is. And so that was one of the surprises. And then there are a couple of the medications that we found in fairly high concentrations. And so that's kind of what's of concern. Not to mention the fact, as you were mentioning in your introduction, that, you know, there are fish populations that use the shoreline for breeding grounds, and we're definitely finding these chemicals within that range of where those fish populations are found.
Do we know how the chemicals are going to affect the ecosystems, the fish, the flora, all that stuff?
So there are some of these compounds where we have some data, and that's what we put in our paper. We're pretty conservative and looked for what we call the risk quotient for some of the pharmaceuticals and personal care products where there's data in the literature, or where, for instance, the Environmental Protection Agency has published databases where they've put information about how these chemicals might affect aquatic organisms or humans, for that matter, out in the literature or on the web. And so we found that there were about 14 of the chemicals where we had significant information where we could look at this risk quotient. And what we found is that there are two of them that were at high risk given the concentrations that were out in the lake. But there are also a significant number of them where we just don't have enough information to actually say what that risk quotient might be for an individual chemical. And so it really points to the fact that we need to have some more information about some of these particular chemicals that we're finding out, especially at higher concentrations. And the other thing not covered in our research is the fact that some of these chemicals, when you mix them together, actually cause a bigger effect. And there's those kinds of mixture studies are kind of hard to do, and they require a lot of different trials of different combinations of chemicals. And so we have significantly even less information about what mixtures of these chemicals might do, even at these low concentrations.
Now, apparently this hasn't shown up in the drinking water in Milwaukee yet, but given what we know now, could it in the near future?
That's a good question. And the places that we were taking our measurements from really were in respect to the sewage treatment plant. And the water intake for Milwaukee in particular is up to the north of where we were sampling. And that's not to say that there isn't some contribution to the lake from, you know, cities that are north of that water treatment plant. But the water treatment plant in Milwaukee has been really forward-thinking and actually started doing some monitoring for these chemicals, you know, several years ago. And from the, you know, the few samples they've taken, they haven't really found a significant number of these things in the drinking water. But there are other communities around the United States that are taking their drinking water from places where they find, you know, even higher concentrations than what we found out in the lake. So it's definitely a concern across the United States as to, well, what happens to humans ingesting just even small quantities of these chemicals over time?
Now, you're talking about more testing being needed, but what do you have an idea what the solution is to get these chemicals clear of the water so that it can be used?
We have been working with Veolia International and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District on a couple of projects looking at different treatment technologies for removal of some of these things. And so, for instance, one of the treatments that we tried, which involved an activated carbon solution that would go at the end of the sewage treatment plant, seemed to remove a good number of these chemicals. But there's a question as to, you know, none of the treatment technologies that are out there so far can remove everything. And so, really, we need some more health information to know which of these chemicals is the most important to remove, and then target our treatment technologies to remove those particular chemicals so that we are best protecting the environment and human health.
How surprising were these results to you? Because, you know, to me, given what we've seen about pollution in the ocean, I guess plastic might be a different animal, but we know that seems to kind of live forever. It just breaks down, but it's still plastic in the ocean. Was it surprising that these chemicals are still alive and kicking in Lake Michigan?
It was surprising that they go the distance that they do and that they're not broken down before that, I think. And the fact that some of them reside in the sediments for a good amount of time is of concern. And people are finding that in other studies as well out in river systems. There's a great study done in Minnesota where they found all sorts of different chemicals going back, you know, several decades that were residing in the sediment structure. It's surprising that we found a few of the chemicals out the distance that we did, and they're not broken down, you know, right away.
So how concerned are you about these findings? Is this a red flag for you, or is this, you know, an all-out warning?
I think it's a red flag and definitely points to the need for, and I know scientists always say we need more research. We need some very targeted research. We've got enough of these studies now where we know that You know, it doesn't matter whether the water body is small or whether it's as large as one of the Great Lakes, but these chemicals are out there and they're of concern, and they might possibly be at a level that is of concern, even in these huge water bodies. And so we really do need to target which of these chemicals is the most significant as far as the potential environmental and health impact, and target their removal. So we need more health information is I think the main story that and we need some information about what these small quantities of these chemicals do out in the environment when they're in a mixture.
Rebecca, is there anything that I can do in my personal life that, you know, if I live in Milwaukee, that's going to keep these chemicals out of the lake?
You know, there are certain chemicals that we find pretty consistently, and others have found consistently in freshwater systems that aren't necessarily needed. So, for instance, the triclosan, triclocarban, products that, you know, if you pick up any kind of antibacterial hand soap, that stuff is in there. And the CDC did a study and looked to see how well those products actually kill bacteria on your skin. And they found that it really, you know, just washing your hands with good old soap and water without that antibacterial compound in there did just as good of a job as if that was in there in the concentrations that it's found in the soap. So, you know, using products that don't contain that antibacterial component, it can decrease the amount that we end up finding in sewage. You know, and we don't want to advocate that people stop taking their medication, obviously, but, you know, I think that there are efforts on the way for what we call more green chemistry, taking into consideration what some of the environmental impacts of these chemicals might be before we actually put them out into the marketplace. And that's been a push by the Environmental Protection Agency, and it continues to be talked about, but we need to talk about it more.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for your interest in our research.
That was Rebecca Clapper. She's associate professor at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and director of the Great Lakes Genomics Center.
Coming up, we'll talk to one of our WPR technology experts about how to avoid being hacked. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
With recent stories of high-profile hacking at the New York Times and elsewhere in our news, it raises the question, if big corporations can get hacked, is our data safe?
Kevin Trueblood joins us now to help protect our email and online accounts. He's one of our technology experts here at WPR. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How worried, Kevin, should we be about protecting our data from the hackers out there?
Well, you know, you should at least have a frame of mind to make sure that your accounts are safe, because they can be hacked a whole lot easier than people think.
So we shouldn't be losing sleep over it, but we should be paying attention to it. Who's after this stuff?
Well, a lot of people think that your accounts are being hacked by somebody sitting in a back room who is, you know, feverishly trying to get into your specific account. And a lot of times that's not really the case. What typically happens is a website is hacked, in the case of like LinkedIn or even other high profile sites like eHarmony have been hacked, and they get into information about users. And one of the more common ways is they will get the email address that is attached to the account on a site like that. And the big no-no is having a shared password, if you have the same password across many different sites.
And that has happened to me, actually. I'm not sure where the initial site was, but I had my personal email with one password and then a bunch of websites and use the same password on it. That is the first piece of advice you have for us, different passwords for different places?
Absolutely, especially your email account. And because the email account is really the key, because if they get to your email account, then they can go and reset your email on many different, or reset your account on many different websites with that same password, and suddenly you can't get into anything.
What do they want with my email account?
Well, just any kind of data that's in it, and also to send out potential, potential scams to some of your friends. They'll send out. I've seen that happen to some of my friends who had their accounts hacked, who said, "I'm stuck in London. I need money wired to me," and they'll send out those kinds of scams.
And it's from my email account, and that's what happened with me. Not the London scam, but something similar. Hey, oh, it's from Rob. I guess I'll look at it, someone might think, except everyone I knew, happily, I think, didn't click the link that came along with that.
That's right.
Well, if you're like a lot of us, though, I mean, how many passwords can we keep in our heads? How do you track having a password for your email, a password for everything, you know, every subscription, every online store, whatever? How do you navigate that?
Well, that's actually a great question. There are some different password managers that you can use. There are many for Mac and for PC that you can actually use that can either keep track of passwords for you, and that is a local utility that you can have that can manage that for you, or generate a password for you as well, something that is secure and unique for each different site. So those are generally an easy way to keep track of all the different ones.
Well, maybe I'm a skeptic, but the first thing I think is, what if the password management site gets hacked?
Well,
and then they got everything, man.
And that is a concern. But some of them are local utilities that that are not shared online.
Okay. So when we start an online account, say a newspaper subscription, or we want to buy something online, are there things we can do to make us less hackable?
The biggest thing is just to use a secure password. And a lot of websites won't even let you use things that are really simple.
And what kind of – so talk about a secure password. ABC123, as I recall, was found to be one of the most common passwords in the world, not very secure.
Correct. And so is password or password one or something like that. The best way to create a password combination is to use a combination of different things. You can do symbols using like the at symbol or an exclamation point, and a mixture of upper and lowercase, and also numbers. So if you wanted to write your pet's name, don't use your pet's name as it is, but maybe change your pet's names, change an E to a 3 or something like that. And also longer. So if you wanted to use like a sentence, 4 or 5 words as a password, that's also fairly secure.
And like, for an example, what's your password for your credit card, Kevin?
ABC123.
Well done. You passed the test. You didn't share that information. Now let's talk about this phishing thing that we get emails from our tech people here all the time. That's phishing.
Phishing with a PH.
Yeah,
correct.
I'm looking right at the word too. Is the funny thing that I couldn't spell it there. What is it? What happens when somebody goes phishing?
Well, there's a couple of different kinds. Phishing is one of the ones that we most commonly know of. You know, is like the Nigerian scam of sending an email to all these people saying, I would love to send you $1 million if you send me $500 first. That is a phishing in terms of they're just trying to find somebody who will bite on that. But what also happens, and this is how higher profile, even some government offices have gotten hacked, is a thing called spear phishing. And spear phishing is where hackers will attack a certain organization, and they will replicate the identity of somebody within the organization and send it to people. So they will think it is from their boss, and it'll say, click here to log into this web portal. And then suddenly they are either downloading something onto their computer, or these hackers have access now to the inside networks of some of these organizations.
So somebody might send you, Kevin, an email that looks like it's from me.
Correct.
It isn't. And then you click the link and boom, they're in.
That's right. That's how a lot of this has happened.
So it sounds really daunting because so much of it is out of our control. If we've logged into a bunch of websites, we can't go out there and protect those websites themselves. If, Amazon got hacked into, you mentioned LinkedIn, just a zillion things with our information out there and our credit card numbers. Is the right reaction to just get offline and do as little possible out there?
You know, it's funny because we are just getting so integrated into the online world and having our credit card saved on Amazon so you can make the purchases easier. And a lot of that stuff is fairly secure and there's not much to worry about. The chances of you being hacked are pretty small, and especially if you use your credit card, you can also... then if you get any fraudulent charges, you can dispute that. But some of the safest things that you can do then is change, you know, use those secure passwords, use different passwords amongst different sites, and then change them often as well. That's another big one. So if you hear of Amazon getting hacked, then you'll want to change especially the password to your email account and make sure that those are, if you hear of some vulnerability like that, that's what you want to do.
For online hygiene, even if we're not hearing bad news like that, how often do you change key passwords anyway that you use?
Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd probably say like every 6 months or so. I don't necessarily have a calendar reminder for me, but especially if I see like some high profile site that gets hacked, then it'll give me a reminder like, oh, I should probably do that. Now, some sites like universities and things like that will actually force you to change your password occasionally.
What every now and then you'll get requests for information via an email, and it's legit. What kind of requests, if we get an email from someone, should set off the tripwire, set off the warning bells?
Well, the big thing is for sites like a bank, for instance, anything that really wants you to log in and verify information, those are usually the ones that should set off flags. And a lot of them look legit. I mean, they will say have the same logo, they will have the same information. But they are completely false, and they will take you to a site that looks an awful lot like what you normally see, but it is designed to fool you, essentially. And so what you want to look for, like I said, is anything that asks for verification. A bank's not going to email you and say, tell us what your account number is just for verification purposes.
They know.
Yeah, they know what it is. And so if you ever have questions like that, every bank has a customer service number. You can call them. And the other thing that I've done, too, is if something doesn't look right, or I'm taken to a login page that doesn't look familiar or doesn't look right to me, or something just it doesn't right, is I will actually manually go to that site. So if it's a bank that's sending me an email, I will go to that bank's website directly.
Not clicking on the link of the email.
Correct. And then see if I see anything. And a lot of times if a bank is having a major security breach or some organization, they'll put it on their website, important security a notice or something like that.
All right. Well, a lot to think about and a lot to do there. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kevin Trueblood. He's one of our resident technology guys here at WPR.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, find out about the science of longer life and whether it could be possible to live forever.
We'll hear about the future of investigative journalism with Bill Leaders of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He'll talk about a time of transition in media and whether there's still room for that kind of reporting.
And we'll get some listening advice as Simply Folk host Stephanie Elkins shares some of her favorite songs. And that's all coming up tomorrow as we get a taste of music and a whole lot more right here on Central Time.